I hope you all had a lovely Passover and Easter. I hope that you had an opportunity to be together with family and friends and celebrate in a real convivial, happy, joyous, food-loving way. So lots of good things going on around the city. There is a continuation of the Cornell Cooperative Extension events that are taking place at public libraries on Long Island. And these are workshops that are geared to help people in lower-income communities learn about healthy eating. And so there's one this Thursday at the Brentwood Library from 7 to 8. It's called Rethinking Your Drink. And there's other ones later on in the month, and you can find out more about those on my website, or if you go to the Cornell Cooperative Extension website, you can find out more about it. Also, Thursday on April 20th, there is a great panel discussion taking place called Food Waste, Food Rescue, an Enlightened Eaters panel discussion. That is being sponsored by Slow Food New York City and the James Beard Foundation and the Natural Gourmet Institute. They're partnering together to bring this panel discussion. It's going to be at God's Love We Deliver, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization that has been really great in giving space to Slow Food New York City for some of these events. But it should be really a wonderful event. It's free. They are asking you to RSVP, though, so you can go onto the Slow Food New York City's website to do that. Also on April 20th, if you happen to be out on Long Island, there is a performance by some members of the Standing Rock community. It's a musical performance out at Stony Brook. And Lila June and Cheryl Engel, who are both indigenous Standing Rock folks, along with their full band, will be performing and also leading discussions. It's free. It's open to the public from 3 to 5 out at Stony Brook Student Activity Center. Also, April 22nd is the March for Science. This is taking place in Washington, D.C. However, there are many, many sister marches taking place around the country. So find out about that. But this is a very important march to stand in solidarity with the scientists that do the research on climate change for us, on chemicals in our food, on pollutants in our waterways. And they are just coming out to the streets because they are tired of having an administration that just denies what they are doing their research on. And so we all need to stand along with the scientists and march with them and make their voices be heard. So come out on April 22nd if you can. Also on April 22nd, there is a march in New York City for Earth Day. And that is, there's actually two different things. There's the Earth Day Sister March. That's going to be taking place at 72nd Street in Central Park West from 10:30 to 4. And then there's also an Earth Day New York City rally to stop Trump's climate agenda. And that's from noon to 1:30 at Foley Square. So either of those are a way that you can get involved. On Sunday, April 23rd, River Woman River Keeper is having an art show at the Odetta Gallery. Go on to the River Keeper's website to find out more information about that. Starting April 23rd is Long Island Restaurant Week. If you happen to be on Long Island and have some restaurants that you've been ooing at that you haven't been able to try yet, this might be a good time to check those out. April 25th, on Tuesday, there is a big rally planned out in Melville, Long Island, to save the Environmental Protection Agency. And this is being organized by many different people. IE Green and Slow Food North Shore is involved. But the main organizer is Food and Water Watch. And this will take place at 12 noon. They've been having regular rallies outside of Schumer's office in Melville. And this is another one, but this one we're really trying to get a good showing. We need Senator Schumer to really take the lead here and help push the Democrats to save the Environmental Protection Agency. That is the organization that is really our only hope of protecting our food and our water from the big corporate polluters that are in Trump's administration. April 27th, there's a meeting to resist the Spectra pipeline. And there's pipelines everywhere. We hear about the Keystone Pipeline, the Spectrus Pipeline. Pipelines in general are not where we should be putting our focus. We need to be putting our focus into renewable energies. And these pipelines just take us down the wrong path. They are transporting dirty crude oil. These pipes always leak. They always pollute our land. And then we are left as taxpayers to clean up the mess. You know, they never hold the people responsible who really should be paying for it. And so we need to resist. And so any opportunity you have to come together to fight these pipelines, please consider doing so. So April 27th is one to resist the Spectra pipeline. This is taking place at the Association Neighborhood and Housing Development on Broad Street in New York City. April 27th, there's the impact of New York City's school gardens. This is a event that's being sponsored by the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College. And these are breakfast seminars that they have on a regular basis, and they're great. I've been to many of them, and they're very informative. It's a really nice opportunity to network and meet other people really working in New York City towards good food policy. So if you can, make that. It's free. They put out a nice spread for a healthy breakfast, and it's really great. Food Tank is a wonderful nonprofit that is very close to my heart. They are really promoting good, good, fair, and clean food, very similar to the Slow Food motto. And they're having a fundraiser, and it's a dance workout at the Highline Ballroom. So that should be really fun if you're interested in that. All of these events, again, I'm just going to say, are listed on my website, so you can find out more information there. April 29th is the really big People's Climate March, and that's what we'll be talking about in just a little bit with my guest today, Nancy Romer. The People's Climate March, there was a huge one back in 2014. This is one coming up in Washington, D.C., and it's really being pushed to be the biggest one yet. We'll be talking about that more, but it's really, really a huge event, and if you can get yourself to Washington, D.C., there's lots of buses leaving the New York area and surrounding communities down to Washington. So it should be a wonderful event. Also, April 29th, if you're not going and you are with family, there's a great event that takes place every year up at Stone Barns Educational Environmental Center. And this one is the sheep shearing. And it's a big family community day. It's the celebration of the arrival of spring. Lots of festivities for the whole family. They show you how to shear sheep. There's farm tours, demonstrations. So if you are around and not participating in the People's Climate March, this might be something else that you'd like to do. Again, there's so many different events. May 4th is a sustainable film series documentary screening of Plastic Paradise. Sustainable Malloy always puts on these film screenings about once a month, and they're free, or there's a suggested donation of $5 that includes a full vegan buffet, so that's a fun thing to do. May 6th, River Keepers Hudson Sweep. That's cleaning up the Hudson River. We all need to participate in that and stand in solidarity with River Keepers. And there's so many more, but I don't want to take the time. So please check out my website and find out more about the events going on in around the city and ways that you can get involved. I want to share with you my weekly recipe before I invite my guest on. This is a super, super simple dish. I'm not that familiar with rutabaga, and so when I saw a recipe for it, I was really excited to try it just because I love becoming more familiar with fruits and vegetables that I'm not familiar with. And so rutabaga is one of those. It's also known as an orange turnip. It's a milder flavor than a white turnip, but it's really very sweet and it's delicious. And this is just a mashed rutabaga. I put a little coconut milk in it and mint in it to just give it a nice rounded flavor. But you're going to start with 2 pounds of rutabaga that you're going to peel and cut into about 1-inch chunks. One piece about 1 inch long of ginger that you're going to peel and grate until it's finely minced. 1.5 teaspoons salt, 1/2 cup of coconut milk, and 1 to 2 tablespoons of chopped mint. And that's it. And so in a large saucepan, you're going to bring some water to a boil and cook the rutabaga in the boiling water along with the ginger and 1 teaspoon of the salt for about 10 to 15 minutes until the rutabaga is tender. Then you're going to drain it and you're going to mash it right into the pot with a potato masher. You can add the coconut milk right into that and the remaining teaspoon of salt. And then add the chopped mint. And like I said, you know, you can do that according to flavor. I think I put in about 2 tablespoons, but you can start with 1 tablespoon and add more as you like. And that is it. Like I said, it's super simple, super quick, but so delicious. So as always, I love getting feedback from all of you when you make my recipes. So if you do make it, let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Nancy Romer. She's a lifelong activist. She served in the Peace Corps in Colombia. And when she came back at the end of the Vietnam War, she continued working for peace and social justice, working in the feminist, anti-racist, public higher education, union, food justice, and climate justice movements. She's a professor, or was a professor of psychology for 42 years at Brooklyn College until she retired 2 years ago. But there's no way of keeping Nancy down. She is a mover and a shaker. She's been working continuously. She's one of the founders of the Brooklyn Food Coalition and worked with that for many years. And since stepping down from running that, she has been traveling and been really involved in working in the food justice realms. And she is one of the organizers of the food and jobs and food justice hub for the Climate March. So I'm really so happy to have Nancy on to talk to us today about the planning of the Climate March. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Bhavani. Thanks for having me on. I always love your work. It's always so connected to people's lives. It's beautiful.
Thank you. And I love having you on because you're always doing such great work. We're like soul sisters.
We are.
You know, everything you're doing is right. What I wish I was doing as well, so it's perfect.
So each of us has only one life, so we have to have a lot of people living connected lives.
That's so right. That's so right. So let's talk about the climate march that's happening right now. I marched with you back in 2014 when the climate march was in New York City, and that was awesome. And now they're doing it again, but this time in D.C. Can you share with us a little bit why they're doing it now?
Well, you know, we had planned this march last summer before we realized that Trump would be our president. And it really started out as a way of pushing the Democrats to be more aggressive on the climate. But of course, once we realized what we were up against with Trump, it really became a resistance and a much greater battle to be able to save what we have achieved in terms of climate, but also to create a new movement. I think that this march, this one is called the March for Climate, Jobs, and Justice. This is a slightly different kind of understanding of what the climate movement needs to be. We're at a very difficult crossroad now with the Trump administration and the attacks on the Environmental Protection Agency and on all of the advances that we've made. We need to create a movement that has a new vision, not just a little incremental change here and there, begging for this law or that law, although we will do that as well. But we really need to create a movement that tries to solve the climate crisis along with social injustice. So for us, the idea of a just transition is critical. So what do we mean by a just transition? Well, we know what we need to do, right? We need to have renewable energy. We need to replace all fossil fuels. We have to have renewable energy everywhere. We know we have to change our entire food system so that it is agroecological, so that the supply lines are much shorter, and so that we are using sustainable agriculture. We understand that those are the things that will be critical. We have to transform retrofit our buildings so that they are not emitting carbon. all of this needs, and we need to end wars, because if we don't end wars, wars create a hell of a lot of carbon. We have to be able to think in a very big way, but we also have to think about who's going to get those jobs, and what kind of jobs are there going to be in this new energy economy. It can't just be the same old people getting the same old jobs. It has to also be people who are most affected by inequality and by climate change, the more vulnerable communities. So we have to rethink how we're going to move on climate change. When we finally have the power to begin to save our planet, it can't only be around climate. It has to also be around social justice, so that we have a world we want to live in, but also so that we have the power, we have the participation that can win the day. And we have to engage everyone. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, in the 2014 climate march in New York City, we said to change everything, we need everyone. And that's true. We still do. But everyone isn't targeted enough. We need to be able to speak very directly to communities that have been left behind. And they need to participate. So that's a shift in the vision. And I think it's a powerful shift. A lot of this thinking, for me at least, was advanced by Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything. And in that book, Naomi Klein talks about how we need a new vision and we need to think out what is the world we're trying to build. And I think it's very important for activists to do that right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've listened to lots of different news broadcasts about, renewable energy and, this administration who, tried to sell itself to people who are really struggling. And it shocked me that those people fell for his agenda. And here they are now, I'm thinking especially of like coal workers, for instance, who are, it's very sad when you listen to the reality of their life right now and what's going on there without jobs and without any other training for them to do work. And, when you were talking about how we have to rethink, we have to find other ways for them to earn a living, because, of course, they want to earn a living. And, I was listening to one guy on public radio talking about how his whole life he just looked forward to becoming a coal miner. And I'm thinking, what he was looking forward to was being able to support himself and his family. And exactly. And we all want them to be able to support themselves and their family. We don't want them not to be able to, but going back into coal is not the answer. So
right. This is exactly, what we're hoping will come out of this. It's going to be a large labor contingent. Labor right now is split on the issue of climate change. There are some unions, some of the building trade unions, some of the mine workers and other pipeline workers, they feel that they want to protect their jobs. But the vast majority of the labor movement feels that we need to make demands for people who must be phased out of their work, but they also must be phased into other concomitant work that also earns a decent living. The labor movement is getting thinner and thinner. We represent a smaller percentage of the American workforce than we have in many, many, many decades, really since the very beginning of the labor movement. And we're losing ground because we're not being creative. And by, I should say, I've been a union activist since 1973. So, and I was an officer of my union that represents the faculty and professional staff of CUNY. It's a professional staff congress. We're an American Federation of Teacher Local. And we feel very much, and the majority of labor feels that we need to have a just transition where we get people out of those jobs that are harming the planet and harming the people, and get them other jobs that will have decent pay, that will be union jobs. And there are all sorts of creative ways to do that. So just give you a little example. So in New York City, a lot of climate activists and labor activists have been pushing for solar panels to be put on every government building in New York City. Well, that is being approached by having independent contractors who generally pay their workers very poorly. There's no job security. They're not great jobs for the workers. They do great work for the rest of us. Very happy to have solar panels, but why doesn't the city have a division in which they are installing the solar panels, and people who are union members, they would be DC 37, AFSCME members, they would be city workers and therefore automatically union members, earning a decent wage, getting decent health care and retirement and all of that. Why shouldn't the work be done by the government that has union labor rather than these small solar firms that do good work but don't really advance the workforce? We can do both at once.
Right.
And that's what we have to be thinking about. How do we give our people good lives, and how do we save our planet? We can do it. We can do both, but we can only do both if we make the demand together.
Right. You know, but in a place like New York, there's so much more opportunity or more need of those kind of jobs. When I think of someone, you know, in the Appalachian, you know, mountains, you know, that has been coal mining, you know, it's like, what are they going to do there? You know, lots of people can work off-site now when they're computer literate. You know, when they're working in the tech world, you don't have to be where the action is. But when you're a laborer, you really have to be where the action is. And
most of the jobs in dirty fuel and fossil fuel are mobile jobs. It's true, mining isn't so mobile, but all the pipeline jobs are very temporary jobs, and those workers are moving around all the time. I had a very interesting experience. I visited Standing Rock in November. I was there for only 5 days, but they were five amazing days to me. I learned so much, and I had so much respect for the people who were engaged in the encampment. But I was sitting with a group of people who were part of what was called the labor camp, and they were workers, the union camp, not the labor camp, the union camp. And we were sitting on, lawn chairs in mid-November, and the sun was just beating down on us. I was putting on all this sunblock, protecting my little white skin, putting a hat on, you know, covering myself up. And then the wind was just whipping around, and, you know, we were getting knocked off our chairs. And we said, isn't this ironic? We're fighting against an oil pipeline when there's all this wind and solar and sun beating down on us. Why can't we develop the technology that already exists, but put the money, put the capital into developing those areas of energy and hire those same workers, you know, to have these clean energy jobs? That's what doesn't happen. It's all based on which corporation is making money right this minute. There's no long-term planning that's done to think about, well, what do we actually need? How can we fulfill those needs? And they're more than only the planetary needs. Those, of course, are the most important. But how can we advance our people while we're saving the planet? So I think we have to think more creatively. We also have to develop, the technology has to be developed for larger batteries to store solar and wind. There's no doubt about that. We're not quite there in solar batteries, but we will be there very soon. Uh-huh. And there's no reason why we can't have the manufacturing of solar panels and wind turbines in the United States and advance that. We could put those factories right near where the coal mining has happened.
Right.
You know, that does not need a particular location. Right. So we could be smart about these things. And that's
Absolutely.
What the labor movement should be demanding, that the government is smart about these things and gives them, keeps them in good jobs and expands good jobs, not just to hold on to something that's going to destroy the planet for their grandchildren and our grandchildren.
Yeah. I can't help but sometimes imagining where our planet would be or our country would be if the solar panels that Carter had put on the White House were still there. And, you know, we didn't go backwards, starting with the Reagan administration. So where do you see a change in climate and food policy coming from in the next several years?
Well, I think that we have to push back against Trump. I think we need to have our senators and our congressional members be very strong in defending the EPA and defending what progress we have made. But I think that we will be most powerful and effective in the cities and in the states. And I think that a lot of work that's been going on by organizations like Food and Water Watch and all the pipeline efforts that have been going on that have been primarily local or regional, I think that's where the change will happen. It won't happen everywhere. I think there many of the, as they say, red states are going to resist, and that will be unfortunate. But I think states like California, Washington, Oregon, New York, hopefully New Jersey, Maryland, Connecticut, Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine, the coastal U.S., and some of the northern states as well. I think we have a chance there in some of the big cities of having an impact that's very important. And, you know, the cities alone produce a huge amount of the greenhouse gases. So there's a lot that we can be doing right there, and that's where the activism is most intense. I feel very confident that in New York City and in the metropolitan region and in the state that we can push our elected officials into a much more protective approach to the environment, to the climate.
Yeah, I know Cuomo has just put a lot of money into the infrastructure to protect our water. I know something that the river keepers are very happy about.
Cuomo's a real mixed bag. I mean, he, on the one hand, he gives you one thing, and then on the other, he takes. He doesn't stand. I mean, he's preening for becoming a presidential candidate. I can't imagine anyone wanting to vote for him for president. But of course, I couldn't imagine anyone voting for Trump. But so obviously, I'm not thinking exactly the way some others are. But I'll give you an example of what he did around, you know, this wonderful gift of free tuition for in SUNY and CUNY for families earning $125,000 a year. It sounds great, doesn't it? And it is great. Except, but it only affects 32,000 students, not the million students that attend CUNY and SUNY. And he has a solid state budget for CUNY and SUNY. He doesn't add any additional money. And both SUNY and CUNY are really on the ropes. They're in desperate need of money. So on the one hand, he's doing a big grandstand on isn't he wonderful to save people that need a college education. And then on the other hand, he's not supporting SUNY and CUNY. Uh-huh. So, you know, he's a slippery fellow. He didn't say a word about all those pipelines that are going under these waterways that are going to potentially be very dangerous for water pollution and extremely dangerous in terms of carbon emissions. He didn't do anything. He helped to decommission Indian Point nuclear power plant, which was wonderful. But then he said nothing about the Ames Spectra pipeline that was going about 150 yards outside of it, that for the next 5 years until it's totally decommissioned, that could explode and we would have an incineration in the New York City area. So, I mean, on the one hand, he looks good, but he doesn't follow through with a broad set of changes that are needed. And we can't afford half steps anymore, and we shouldn't be applauding half steps. We have to push a whole lot harder. But pushing a whole lot harder has to include a whole lot more people. And I think that that's what's happening now. And we stand a chance for some huge movement building. One of the things that I'm very excited about, this climate march, is that it includes so many different groups. There are about 200 different groups on the steering committee. There are thousands of organizations that have come forward and endorsed the march. And there are these hubs or contingents that are growing and represent so many different sectors of the American population. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is. That's one thing that I guess the silver lining of the Trump administration is that all of the grassroots can come together under one umbrella to fight for these issues that we all share in common, that it's
well,
so important.
That's the hope. We can't be in the silos. And that's why I'm particularly happy about the idea of climate, jobs, and justice, because it unites more ideas together. And I think we have to start coalescing and sharing some strategy so that we can win.
Yeah.
I think we can win, and I think we have to win.
I'm with so. You.
So I would like to say something also about the Food and Farm Justice Hub, because you were there 2.5 years ago when we had the food justice contingent, remember, at the climate march. We had, you know, we were beautiful and we were exciting and we had a lot of great people, but we hadn't really organized it to the extent that this round is organized, highly, highly organized.
Good. Share with us what's going on. Share us what, you know, about the Food and Farm Justice Hub.
Okay, so in December, people from about 50 different organizations that are food and climate related in the New York metropolitan area got together, and we decided that we would organize to get people to go to the April 29th Washington, D.C. March for Climate, Jobs, and Justice. So it was such a pleasure to see this all coming together. People just got down to work. They did an enormous amount of outreach. They did some fundraising. It was just magnificent. And we have a lot of young people. We have a lot of people of color. We have older people. We have people from all of the boroughs going. And we're sending 7 buses for the Food and Farm Justice Hub from New York City alone. There are lots of other people coming from lots of other places. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of buses that will be going to Washington, D.C. But the Food and Farm Justice Hub is very specifically organized, and we're very excited about it. We will be joined by the U.S. Food Sovereignty Alliance, which is a national organization that works on how we can better control our food system and take it away from corporate control and bring it back to the hands of small-scale and medium-scale farmers and consumers. So they are a very exciting group, and we're so happy that they will be part of it. Also part of our Food and Farm Justice Hub will be representatives from La Via Campesina, which is an international organization. It has 250 million members. It's the largest non-religious organization in the world, and they are sending representatives, and we will be so happy to be marching with them. We'll have gorgeous banners and posters. We're doing all this artwork this week, and it's all shaping up to be very exciting. So this is going to be an important part of the march. There also will be contingents of faith contingents and labor contingents and youth contingents and you know, lots of different groupings. But this one I'm particularly proud of. If we have to face that we can't feed ourselves as we have been feeding ourselves in a different climate. Agriculture on our planet is very dependent and always would be dependent upon the climate that the food is growing in. And as the climate changes, we will have to change agriculture. One of the big problems that we have with large-scale corporate agriculture is they mostly they grow monocrops, which means corn, hundreds and hundreds of acres of corn, or hundreds and hundreds of acres of soy, etc. And what's problematic about that is that they are extremely vulnerable. Those crops end up being very vulnerable to climate change, to insects, to disease, various things like that. Monocrops, that is growing just one thing, is not resilient. And we need to have crops that are going to be resilient. We need to have lots of different kinds of crops, different species, different varieties, in order to be able to see, well, what is going to survive, what will be resilient in the face of climate change in general, but specifically the Northeast is expected, and this comes from the Environmental Protection Agency, we expect in the Northeast for there to be much more precipitation and heavier precipitation. So on the one hand, we think, hey, that's great, we're going to have water. You know, look at California, they're not going to have so much water. Here's the problem. Too much water is not such a good thing, and it can completely flood crops. That's not so good. The other problem is that we're going to have more very, very, very hot days, and that will change what we can and can't grow and the conditions under which we can grow it. Also, we've seen this year, we've seen it many years in the past 10 years, that spring starts and then it all of a sudden ends and winter returns. When that happens, we have very extreme and unusual climate incidents. When that happens, that can kill, like it killed the peach crop this year on the East Coast. You know, agriculture is dependent upon more or less stable seasons so that the farmers can know what to grow and when to plant and to harvest, all of that. So the large-scale farms are, they're going to be useless at some point. We need to be able to, right now, invest in the small and medium-scale farms that are biodiverse and that are use agroecological practices so that we can continue to feed ourselves. And if we can't stop this fast progression of climate change, we're going to have a hard time feeding ourselves as well. That's why anyone who's interested in food needs to also be a climate activist.
You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Nancy Romer, food activist and one of the organizers of the Food and Farm Justice Hub for the Climate March that is going to be taking place in just a few weeks on April 29th down in Washington, D.C. Nancy, you know, we've been talking a lot about the Climate March, which is just so exciting, and I'm really thrilled to see how many millions of people we actually get there in Washington. But you've also been doing a lot of great work traveling, going down to South America.
I'm going to stop you for one second and be very rude. What I did not do is to give people the website to see how they can get on a bus. Right?
Oh, sure.
How could I have done that? That was crazy. So go to peoplesclimate.org, and you can click on to their transportation, and you can get on a bus, but I do it right away, because as we get closer, the seats will be taken. And you can also check out the website of the the Facebook page of Food and Farm Justice. That will also give you information on how to join our buses.
Great. Great. And there's lots of, you know, lots of smaller groups are also having buses. So if they don't join the Food and Farm Hub groups, they can find some local buses as well. I just know there's, you know, there were so many that went down for the Women's March that I was fortunate enough to go to. And, you know, it's really a great day trip. I mean, it's, you know, it's really worthwhile going. So I encourage everyone to jump on a bus if you can make it.
There will be a map on the peoplesclimate.org site that tells people where the meeting points will be for the various hubs. So if people do want to be part of the Food and Farm Justice Hub, they can connect that way.
Great, great. Thank you. So now can you share with us a little bit about some of your travels to, where'd you go, South America, Central America?
Well, I'm on a quest to learn more. And then I try to write about it, what I feel will be interesting and useful to people who care about food and climate. So I've been so fortunate to be able to travel. So this past winter, I spent 9 weeks in Bolivia and in Peru. and I got to see a lot of incredible agriculture. I mean, I must say, every time I get to see small-scale farms, I am so impressed with the knowledge, the love, the hard work that farmers engage in and have always engaged in. I grew up thinking farmers were not smart. You know, like, oh, well, the farmer, you know, like farmers were not smart. I now know that farmers are among the smartest and the most knowledgeable people. They understand so much about science. They are the first line of scientific workers. And I'm always impressed. So I was mostly in the Andes. And the Andes have, the people in the Andes have been using terracing. That is, on the sides of mountains, they have what are basically like ledges. And they have microclimates to that as you go up and down in these ledges, they can grow different kinds of food. And they also have irrigation systems within that terracing that that maintain a water supply for the various crops. So they grow an incredible range of different kinds of crops, and they have historically been able to feed their people and serve and store their food for long periods of time. And so that was just incredible. I traveled with a little bit with a group called Sierra Productiva, which is an organization that's part of this Institute of Alternative Agriculture in Peru. They have 70,000 farmer members, and they are all either practicing or moving toward practicing organic farming. They, because of the detail of their land reform about 40 years ago, most of the farms in Peru are between 2 and 6 hectares. So that's between, between 1 and 6 hectares. So that's between 2 and 12 acres. They're small farms. And they work closely together, farmer to farmer, to aggregate their produce so that they can sell it more easily. But their approach is you feed your family first, you feed your community second, and then you think about the market. Instead of growing cash crops, which I've seen in Central America, where the big corporate farms are pushing for cash crops, I saw this also in India. And when that crop fails, as I described earlier, you know, with monocrops, when that crop fails, they have nothing to eat. On a biodiverse farm where you may have 60 or 70 different plants that you're growing, then you're going to be able to eat something. Something's right. Going to make it through. And so instead of growing for this market, you grow in a much more direct way. So I was very impressed with that. I was also very impressed with the kinds of workshops that these farmers participated in which they learned how to make their own solar and wind energy. So they're not dependent upon the electrical grid. And I visited some farmers that had that used no electric at all, outside of what they generated through the solar and the wind power on their farms. And I even saw a refrigerator that was all adobe, and the bottom shelf of the refrigerator had a pan of cold water and a very tightly closed door, and they could save meat and dairy and vegetables, and it used no energy. And I mean, and people are teaching each other these methodologies. They're very inexpensive, and we can be much more self-sufficient and not be constantly paying the big corporations to allow us to live and work.
Right.
I was very impressed by that. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Now, did you also witness some of the land grabbing that's going on down there, or the wiping out of some of the Amazon to raise animals and graze animals?
I did not go to the Amazon this time, but But a couple of years ago, I went to Central America. I went on a food sovereignty delegation with Grassroots International, which is a fantastic organization. We went as a small delegation to Honduras and Guatemala. And in both places, but particularly in Honduras, where the level of violence was horrifying. There was a lot of land that had been grabbed. You know, what happens in nations where people are still on the land as indigenous people, and this is true in Central America, South America, Africa, Middle East, everywhere, and in our nation too, that they don't always hold title to the land. In the United States, pretty much everyone holds title to the land, that is, you have the deed. But in a lot of these other nations, particularly nations in the global south or what we used to call the third world, there is not that codification. So if you leave the land or you're pushed off through violence, then other people can come on the land and quickly, in cahoots with governments, get a title to the land. And then you have no recourse. And I saw that happening in Honduras like crazy. And in Guatemala, to a significant extent, we visited with communities of people that were fighting back and trying to retake their land. And I've seen a lot of poverty. I've never seen anything as severe as the poverty of these farmers who were squatting on the land to reclaim the land that their ancestors had lived on and worked on. The poverty was astounding. But the spirit of the people to work together, they were almost all women, by the way. There were very few men involved. The women were so dedicated to retaking this land and working the land. And everyone, I visited at about 10 o'clock in the morning on this particular day. And we said, well, where are the kids? And they said, well, they're in school. Where do you think they are? You know, of course they're in school. We're bettering ourselves. You know, every child walked the proverbial several miles a day each way to go to school. And when I asked the women, you know, how many children do you have, hold up fingers, you know, almost everyone said one or two children. They said, well, we don't want to have so many children, we can't feed them. So here they're on their own deciding that they're going to control their reproduction because they want to be able to give their children good lives. These are hardworking, highly organized women who wanted that land back. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, when I visit people like this and I see the importance of their land to their future and to the well-being of their families and their communities, and then I think that my retirement money is being used to steal land from peasants and to take land and deforest it to grow monocrops to feed cattle, I must say it's very disturbing. We know that these practices are going on in many, many places, but peasant organizers in Brazil that are part of Movimiento Sem Terra, which is Movement of Landless Peasants in Brazil, they are a member organization of La Via Campesina. They came to researchers at one of the universities in Brazil and they said, this is what's going on. We want you to research it and prove that TIA is using front organizations, like shell organizations, to steal the land. And then TIA, you know, with their white gloves on, they say, oh, we'll buy the land. And they are also participating in deforestation. So as a TIA investor and as a food sovereignty activist, I've been involved with this campaign to get TIA to stop buying grabbed land from peasants and to stop deforesting the land that they have. And it sounds really great on your little portfolio, your retirement portfolio. Agricultural lands sounds wonderful. But when you find out that some of those lands are really being very destructive to the people, but also to the planet, then you really want to do something about it.
Sure. And can you share with my listeners how they could get involved in that if they
sure.
want to find out, you know, and protest or speak out against their own retirements? What can they do?
Well, this Thursday, That's April 20th, 11:30 to 1 p.m. We're having a demonstration in front of a TIA. We'll be marching from St. Agnes Catholic Church on 143 East 43rd Street between Lexington and 3rd Avenue. But by noon, we will be in front of the TIA headquarters, which is at 730 3rd Avenue between 45th and 46th Street. So if you're on a lunch break and you want to be outside and march with us, that would be great. We are asking TIAA to be transparent, to publish the locations of all of the agricultural land that they own, and so that we can verify that that land is either not grabbed or not engaged in deforestation. Mm-hmm. So please come. So that's this Thursday, 11:30 to 1 in Midtown. And you can check that out by going to the Friends of the Earth website. They've been the most active on this. And also we have a Facebook page that is a TIA. I'm embarrassed to say I don't have the Facebook page here.
They can find it.
Yeah.
No problem. They can find it.
Thank you.
Great. Oh God, the work you're doing is just amazing. And you know, and how it's all connected is, you know, something that I talk to people all the time. I mean, you, like you said earlier, you can't care about your food and your water and not being an environmentalist. They're just so interconnected, and yeah, you can't care about one without caring about the other. And it's important that all of us participate, because another thing I say all the time is the big corporations, they have the money. We cannot compete with the amount of money that the rich billionaires that Trump and his administration is surrounding them with, and all the corporate people that are involved in, you know, the gas and oil companies and the pharmaceuticals and the chemical companies and the Monsantos. There's no way we can raise that kind of money. But we have the numbers of people. We can combat them by coming together with millions of people instead of millions of money. Millions of people, and stand up against this all these unfair practices, and you know, put a stand and say we want a future in our planet, and we care about our planet, and we are not okay with you greedy millionaires, billionaires, wrecking it all for us. It's just not okay.
But, you know, I agree with that. I also think we have to have a consciousness change for Americans. We really become a very complacent group, and people often will have their special charity or their special interest, and that's great. That's a beautiful thing. You don't want to lose that. But we have to take a step back and look at the very big picture and decide how we want to participate in that big picture. Because if we don't participate in that big picture, we won't get our little picture to move forward either. And I think one of the things that I love about the food movement is that people have contributed so much time and energy to helping others. And that is very unique and wonderful in American culture. But I think that it would be even more powerful if those very same people could take that next leap forward and see that they are needed in the big picture. We also have to have a good time doing what we're doing. And one of the wonderful things about these marches is that it brings out all this creativity, all the gorgeous artwork, all the songs, all the chants, all the good feelings within a community that sends these buses forward, that sends these people to these marches, that then coalesces afterwards and creates stronger organizations back home. So I think it's a very, very beautiful thing, and I hope that your listeners will participate and go to peoplesclimate.org and get on a bus and fulfill the promise that we make to future generations. You know, many indigenous peoples have this idea of the seventh generation. And it's not just a corporation that's selling toilet paper, which is fine. But the idea behind it is that that you have to make decisions for now according to how it will affect seven generations in the future. So, in other words, forget the quarterly report. Forget the bottom line. That cannot be how we live, because we will burn ourselves, literally, we will burn ourselves out. We need to be able to think about seven generations down. What are we giving to those people, to those progeny that are going to come forward? People fuss over their children tremendously. They worry, they hover, they do all these things to ensure that their children are happy and healthy and safe. But they also need to be thinking about what will it be for their children if they're facing climate disasters all the time? Yeah. And what will it be for their children's children to have those climate disasters be a constant part of their lives? They don't want that to happen. So they have to take some of the time that they're spending doing whatever else they're doing and participate in these movements for a new world. We must have a new world. Or we won't have humans on it.
It's so true. It's so true. Well, Nancy, thank you for doing your part and doing what you do and for inspiring so many others to take part. And everyone, please go to the website, peoplesclimate.org, and sign up for a bus. Get yourself down to Washington. If you can't make it, participate in whatever you can find in your local community. But let your voices be heard and take a stand. And Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much, and keep up the good work. And unfortunately, I am not able to make it to Washington. It's killing me. I really thought there was going to be a sister march in New York and I'd be able to do that. But as you said, the feel good feeling, you know, I did go to the Women's March and it was just wonderful. You ride on that energy for a long time afterwards. The glow is just wonderful. And so
check out the week before, next week, check out, there will be some smaller events going on April 29th in the New York metropolitan area and in many other places. We, of course, want everyone to go to Washington who possibly can, but there will be some small events. There won't be a big march, though, in Washington, in New York City.
Right.
We just are not doing that one.
Right, I know. So anyway, I will be at one of those smaller ones for sure. But everyone listening, thank you again for joining us. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.